next session, really. And we already had a bit of an invocation in our morning meditation of Akshobhya. So this morning, we will have time together exploring the Buddha Akshobhya and the wisdom, mirror-like wisdom. And we'll do that, I'll talk to start with for some time, then we'll meditate together. And then we'll go into groups for a bit and then we will have a ritual. So that will be what the morning will look like for us. And I just want to start with saying with Ratnadeva, he was introducing and marking the territory for us yesterday. And yesterday evening, and it made me think, you know, how do we get to experience? How do we get to be? How do we get to kind of have our sense of being who we are, how we kind of experience the world? And he offered to us the verses from Dhammapada, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind and produced by mind. And the quality of my experience, the way that I experience myself in this world, is to do with the way my mind is working. I think that whole implication of that is just totally profound. When I take that on and really think about it and ponder that, that experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind and produced by mind, it's mind-blowing. If you are like me and you enjoy having a sense of control, well, here it is. You know, I've got the joystick to my own experience. I can be behind the driving wheel of my experience. I can be the painter, the creator of the world that I am inhabiting. So I can create my experience, I can create my world. And Buddhist teachings give us, they give us the tools of how to work with our minds and the mind that we can work on and mold and shape our experience. So we get those tools from Buddhist teachings. And on one hand, you could think, you know, it's liberating and also it poses a responsibility. And if you take on responsibility really fully, it can sound a bit daunting. So I would invite you to take that moment of liberation. So having that as an invitation. So you focus on the ability to be in charge and it can be really playful. So you can do it playfully. You know, it doesn't have to be heavy or burdensome. It doesn't have to be hard work. It can be playful in the way that we take on that responsibility and that we can work with our minds. And sometimes I do these acts of imagination or like these thought experiments. And I imagine things as if. So like last week I was on the bus traveling for about an hour from West London Buddhist Center. And I was, you know, I was getting pretty stressful because what I was seeing around me were people not wearing the masks. So, and I had a couple of masks in my bag. And what I thought, I'm just going to offer a person who's sitting right in front of me, I'm just going to offer them a mask. And I thought, imagine if I just offer that mask and that was nothing but love in that gesture. You know, that experience would be not colored by anything, but just this pure act of giving something to someone to help everyone on that bus to be kind of protected from the virus. And so it's those, having those little glimpses where we can you know, when we can see what it could be like, what it could be like when we just act out of that positive mental state, out of love, out of compassion, out of kindness, out of a real clarity of mind, out of understanding that we not separated from others, and that we are connected with each other. So I think that kind of brings me to other thing that Ratnadeva mentioned yesterday. And he was talking about the biggest predicament that we have as human beings. And that is that whenever we experience, or our minds create experience, we do that through the five processes that he mentioned. But these processes are governed by ignorance. And that ignorance is really rooted in our mistaken self-view. So we constantly see ourselves as separate and fixed from others. We see ourselves separate from the world. So we keep making that distinction between ourselves as distinct from the world. It's us here and the world there. I can see, you know, I've got this experience of myself here, and then I see these little boxes on my computer and I think, well, that's you over there in those boxes. So there is this separation constantly going on. And I love Ratnadeva's image of describing us as prisoners of dualistic and conceptual thinking. You know, we're prisoners. And I don't know whether you sometimes get that sense of being a prisoner. I was just on a retreat with a really dear, dear friend of mine. And we had a together, rather than solitary, we had a duetry where we did a retreat together. And sometimes we would be talking in between our sessions. And in those moments, you would sometimes get to a point where, you know, there was me having particular experience trying to describe that. And my friend saw things very differently. And in that point, you see that kind of, you know, like this tension of like me, my view, my experience, and my friend, like this other entity that see things differently. So there is that separation. And in that moment, you can feel the prisoner being a prisoner. You know, you can almost feel yourself like you in a cell of experience, which is not right, yet it seems so, so evocative. It seems so real. So I want to share with you a quote from Khyentse Rinpoche. And it's a beautiful kind of image of water and ice. So he says, in the heart of winter, the chill freezes lakes and rivers, and water becomes so solid that it can bear men, beasts, and carts. As spring approaches, earth and water warm up and thaw. And what that remains on the hardness of the ice? Water is soft and fluid. Eyes hard and sharp. So we cannot say that they are identical, but neither can we say that they are different. Because ice is only solidified water, and water is only melted ice. And the same applies to our perception of the world around us. To be attached to the reality of phenomena, to be tormented by attraction and repulsion, by pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and obscurity, praise and blame, that creates solidity in the mind. And what we have to do, therefore, is to melt the ice of concepts into the living water of the freedom within. So there is this melting of the ice of concepts, so we can become, our minds can be more fluid, and we can move away from that distortion of our mind where we have got this mistaken view of self, separate self. And I think what I want to focus on is that first part of our experience, when we, when the process of the mind in each moment gets going. So Ratnadeva mentioned the five processes. So the first constant of our enlightened experience is contact. So with the contact, we have senses, and through those senses, we get to experience the world. And we make meaning, we become conscious of our perceptions. So in this perceptual situation, this contact is the initial part of the process of us making sense of something or someone. So the contact is just that process of sense faculty meeting an object, an eye meeting a form, for example, a picture. So it's that bare illumination of the object. It's raw awareness that something is out there. We just get that kind of feeling of, yeah, my eye has rested on an object, and that contact is that initial part of a process. And in Buddhism, we have six senses. So we've got our five senses. We've got eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. And they come into contact with visual, sound, smells, taste, touch. But in Buddhism, we also have the mind. And the mind gets into contact with our memory, images that pop in our minds, thoughts. So in each mind moment, we've got these constant contacts taking place. You know, just as we are right now, you know, you're if you focus on what you're sitting, there is a contact there just now. Yeah. If you're looking at the screen, there is a contact, your eye making a visual sort of consciousness, so you become conscious of what you're actually seeing. Millie has got that incense stick, so she's got her nose sort of making contact with that smell of incense sticks. And it would be all fine for us humans, if we could just stick at that. You know, when we smell an incense stick, if it could just be that. If we see people on the screen, if it could just be that. If, for example, we've got something itchy, my ear might be itchy, if it could just be that itch for a moment. Yeah, but we don't do that. And this is where the enlightened mind comes into it. The enlightened mind has got a very different way of being or coming into experience. So there is this mirror-like wisdom. So rather than for us having this distorted contact in which we already start the process of us being separated from others and viewing ourselves falsely as separate and fixed, mirror-like wisdom is just experiencing things as they really are. So it's the first aspect of the enlightened, liberated, illuminated mind, the mirror-like wisdom. And it's an intuitive way of knowing that is totally free of delusion and egoistic contamination. And this image of mirror is just very fitting. If you have an object and you put it in front of a mirror, if that mirror is clean without any kind of, you know, if you haven't smudged it with something, you will just get a really clear reflection of that object. There will be no distortion, there will be no contamination. So that's what mirror-like wisdom perceives. Nothing is added, nothing gets taken away, there is no alteration taking place. So with mirror-like wisdom, you just see, hear, or experience things as they really are. And in that process, the structure of perception, so how you perceive things, is not mistaken for reality. So we perceive something and we actually see it for what it is. So for example, if I might have pins and needles in my foot, it might be just something that arisen in reliance upon conditions. Yeah, my leg has been in a particular way, and that means the blood is not getting in there. And because of those conditions that are in place, there is a particular experience. And if I know that that experience is only momentarily, whilst those conditions last, then I'm seeing things as they really are. Then there is that wisdom, there is that mirror-like wisdom. Yeah? So mirror-like wisdom can see all acts of perceptions as relative. Yeah, they depend on conditions. And in the moment when you perceive things and you're aware of that, you're having mirror-like wisdom. It's an enlightened mind that is in operation. Just another sort of lovely quote from Khinsei Rinpoche again. He says, if you know how to leave your thoughts free to dissolve by themselves as they arise, they will cross your mind as a bird crosses the sky without leaving any trace. So the mind is the sixth sense in Buddhism. Thoughts arise. And if thoughts arise and you just recognize them as arising independent of conditions, something that comes along will pass. And if you don't attach to those thoughts at that point, don't add anything to them, don't take anything away from them, they will just pass like birds in the sky and you will not see any trace of them. And in that way, that's liberation. William Blake similarly said, he said, I look through my corporal eye, not with it. So there's this, again, that whole idea of just seeing perception for what it is, seeing conditions for what they are, rather than attaching other meanings to them. So Ratnadeva yesterday talked about personification of the various qualities of enlightenment. And he really beautifully or eloquently described the importance of personification. And he said we would be entering this mandala of the five Buddhas this weekend and imagining them as doorways, and those doorways helping us to transcend and go beyond. So these five Buddhas, they're sometimes referred to as jinnas. And jinna means a conqueror. And they refer to as conquerors because they have overcome ignorance and they've entered the realm of reality. So they're able to be in that territory, in that particular vision, have that vision, so they can teach us about reality and about how to work with our mind. So the Buddha Akshobhya that we were invocating this morning is inhabiting the Eastern realm. And I loved what Mark said. It's amazing. It was 5:30 in New York this morning, and Akshobhya, the Buddha of Eastern realm, is associated with the dawn. So Mark is definitely on the right time zone for Akshobhya, and definitely was in that in the morning when he probably meditated about 2-3 o'clock in the morning for the first sit. And I just love that that the stars are aligned with us. We've got the Venus in the east. So it's like Akshobhya in the Eastern realm, inhabiting that Eastern realm. And a different word for akshobhya, or how akshobhya can be translated, is being immutable, imperturbable, or unshakable. And where that comes from is from this mythical sort of origin, where we have a monk who approaches a particular Buddha in one of the realms, Abhirati, and he says, look, I've got my mind set on enlightenment. I want to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And the monk said, well, you will have to really make commitment. This is not an easy task. And he says, yeah, I forswear all feelings of anger. And he made lots of vows. He said he would never give way to anger or malice, or he would not engage even in the slightest unethical actions. And in some ways, he was unshakable in his commitment. He was unshakable in taking those vows into fruition. So as the result of that, we've got the figure of akshobhya, the unshakable or imperturbable, and he's got this pure land, which is kind of signifies his enlightened mind or enlightened consciousness, what it's like. And he resides over that Eastern realm. And according to descriptions, this Eastern realm has got palm trees, got jasmine, there is breeze, palm trees moving about. And you've got the heavenly sounds that go beyond any. Imagine the most beautiful, delicate sounds in worldly terms. So in Abhirati, it's just the sound there goes beyond. And there is food and drink, everything is abandoned. There is no illness, no COVID, no illness. And it's interesting, in the scriptures, it even mentions that women don't have a menstruation pain. I mean, what a pure land that is. And once you enter that pure land, there is no way back. You cannot regress. So once you are inhabiting that particular pure land, that particular Abhirati, Eastern realm, you are well and truly on the way to enlightenment because you embody that particular aspect or quality of the mind. So akshobhya belongs to a particular family, and that is the family, Vajra family. And Vajra is a very particular symbol, and I did put Vajra on the shrine, and I think Millie also mentioned that she's got her Vajra nearby. So this symbolic diamond thunderbolt, we had it in dedication ceremony. We said the wall of Vajras is, you know, it can bring about this determination. And akshobhya, he actually holds the Vajra upright in his palm, in his left palm. And originally, within Indian tradition, it's kind of like an emblem of sovereignty. But what it symbolizes here is this total and utter irresistible force meeting an immovable object. So you've got fusion of immutable qualities and irresistible force. And it's very corresponding to other mythologies. So for example, in Greek mythology, we've got Zeus with his thunderbolt and Hera. Or in Norse mythology, you've got the Thor with his hammer. So there is this real irresistible force and unshakability. And what it symbolizes is transcendental reality. And when we've got this wisdom, mirror-like wisdom, that's what we actually, that's what we realize in that particular intuitive wisdom, that transcendental reality, that irresistibility, immutable quality. So there is so much symbolism in this Vajra. You've got the sphere in the middle that just unites all polarities. So you've got that dualistic way of thinking sort of united into one, into this unity. You've got lotus flowers here on the sides, and they, again, you've got them, the world of opposites being united together. So we've got ignorance and enlightenment sort of being united. And it was a little bit like what we said with the Khyentse Rinpoche, with the ice and water. You know, you no longer think of ice and water as different, because ice is melted, ice is solidified water, and water is melted ice. So you've got this unification of experience. And I don't know if you can see that, but there are these hats, crocodile-like hats. A makara is the animal that is being depicted here. And it's very much the meeting of our heights, a little bit like we were meditating today and really focusing on sort of lifting up into the sky. So you've got this heights, conscious heights and unconscious depths meeting together. So the crocodile or the makara symbolizes that meeting of the highs and total depths, unconscious depths. And we've got different prongs here. And these prongs, on one hand, can symbolize the qualities of the or faculties of the enlightened mind. And on the other hand, they can sort of symbolize the five poisons or something, so sort of the unenlightened mind. And again, you know, all of that is connected together. So within Buddhism, the good thing is that whenever we experience something negative, like if hate arises, you know, if ill will arises, it's like, yes, I've got an opportunity to work here, because I can transform that hate. I can take that energy that is tied up in that particular mental state, and I can change and transform that energy. And out of that comes a different way of being or different way of experiencing. You know? So Akshobhya is very, very much associated with hatred and ill will. There is a total transformation of hatred and ill will. And again, here you've got that energy taken from hatred and ill will, because you know, when you hate somebody or when hate arises, it's very clear cut. You know, there is like, there is no question about that energetical feeling that you have at that time. So if you can take that clarity and apply that clarity to the real enemy that we have, which is suffering for us, and this ignorance, if we can gather that energy, we can transform that particular negative experience. So maybe I'll say one more sort of quality of Akshobhya, or some of the symbolism that we have with Akshobhya, and that is the fact that he is touching the ground with his hand. He's calling the ground, he's calling it to witness. There is this unshakable confidence and sort of trust in seeing things as we are. And the way we're looking at this particular material, we are following a particular school of thought. So we are very much in the Yogacara interpretation of the mind. We're really looking at how the mind works from a Yogacara point of view. So it's a very particular way of looking. And the Yogacara comes out of a very meditative experience where people really spend times in meditative states for hours, days in exclusion, really looking at experiences that they were having. And out of those experiences, out of their kind of mapping of their inner world, they came up with this model of the mind. And one of the things that they sort of had a direct experience of is that whatever we do, there is consequence as a result. So they had a real experience of karma or actions having consequences. And in some ways, Akshobhya and his kind of witnessing demonstrates that particular aspect of our minds where we can really look into the deep-seated sort of aspects of our past actions, and we're able over time to transform our actions so our mind changes because it's no longer contaminated by negative ethical choices, experiences, and thoughts. So Akshobhya is very much associated with that particular transformation of the mind, of that ethical aspect of our mind. So Akshobhya is the Buddha of truth. He, for us, personifies the mirror-like wisdom. And it's because he sees things as they really are. He sees them impartially and unaffected. And water is his element, and water is very much like the mirror. So there is never a reaction. There is just mirroring of what is. So there is that focus on direct experience rather than having our experience filtered through concepts and ideas. And that is what we're going to be training ourselves in a moment when we're going to do meditation together. So we will meditate for a period of time, and we'll be looking at our experience and trying to really focus on that direct experience where we can just be with what is for a moment. So I'll say a little bit more in preparation for that. You could sit in the meditation if you like, or if you prefer, and you would find it more helpful to lie down, you can also lie down for this meditation. We'll meditate for about half an hour, or just after half an hour, under half an hour. So you can either sit in meditation or you can lie down. And when we're working with our minds, and when we're trying to enter the mandala, it is a lot about letting go. Ratnadeva said yesterday, he said, maybe the mandala is already here. It's everywhere around us. And all we need to do is just get in touch with that, which means we have to just let go of all the sort of, all these ideas and things that we have about experience, and just get in touch with the direct experience. So I invite you to set yourself for meditation. And we'll do a meditation where we will be focusing on our senses and experience through our senses. So just a way of settling in, first of all, just notice yourself sitting or lying down in the space that you are inhabiting right now. Noticing all sensations that may be going on. Your breath. Breath that makes you alive. Just letting all those words and sounds from the talk sort of let them be, let them settle, let the mind settle. In this first stage, just allowing visuals behind your eyelids to pop up. Noticing any dots, any shapes, color. Just letting those visual impressions impress upon your mind. Not adding anything in. Not taking anything, not even labeling. Just being with those visual sensations. In the scene, only the scene. Moving your attention from the eye to ear. Just resting your attention on sounds. Letting the sounds come in. Just letting them be. In the herd, only the herd. Just listening to the sound impression. Just listening. Maybe just relaxing. Just seeing that awareness. For sounds to arise. And that field of awareness. In the heart, only in the heart. Moving your attention from the ear to the nose. Noticing any smells that arise with each in-breath. In the smell, only the smell. Just staying with that contact. Just smelling. moving our attention from the nose to the tongue and our taste buds. And just noticing any taste. Maybe some residual taste from our breakfast or from a cup of tea. Just resting our attention on that immediate experience, taste. In the tasted, only the tasted. Moving our attention to the sensations of our skin. The contact present of a fabric against our skin. Noticing the sensations in the touched, only the touched. And the sixth sense of the mind. Just letting thoughts, memories arise. Letting them arise and pass away. in the cognized, only the cognized. In your own time. Maybe opening your eyes, letting the visuals in. Just bringing the meditation to a close. So here we have had a little training of a mirror-like wisdom when contact can come in and we don't contaminate it and we don't bring the self into it and we just let it arise and pass away. So what we can do for a moment now, we can go into our breakout groups and we'll have about 20 minutes in breakout groups. So these will be our random breakout groups, which might allow you to meet some new people different from your home group that you will see this afternoon. And in the groups, it's an opportunity for you to look into the mirror-like wisdom. You can see what your experience was like in training then. And you've got an opportunity to begin to get in touch and share what Akshobhya evokes for you. That symbolism of Akshobhya and the various symbols associated with him. So we'll have 20 minutes. Ratnadeva will send us off on our way, and then we'll give us a 5-minute warning before the end.